Welcome to the 8th episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm Melissa Megan, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Jackie DeVore.
Hello.
And Sierra Houck.
Hello.
And tonight we have a special guest, Drew Van Genderen, host of the For the Love of Indie podcast. Hi, Drew.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Great.
Yes.
We're doing awesome. We're going to jump right in right here at the beginning with a new segment that we've decided to add in that I'm just going to kind of casually call Grill the Guest. We've come up with a group of questions that we want to grill our new guest with so that we can all get a good idea of who he is right off the bat. Are you ready?
Born ready.
All right. And just so everybody knows, we did not give Drew these questions ahead of time. He is totally on the spot right now. Be gentle with him.
To be fair, they aren't very hard questions.
No.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So, Drew, the first question is, if you were in a slasher film, which character would you want to be? And which character would you realistically be?
Okay. They're probably going to be about the same answer, which is the kind of jokey guy who probably goes first. Because I'm going to be real here. I would be cracking jokes in that situation. And when it comes down to it, I'm just, not really in shape enough to really make it. Let's be real.
So you would just be the first one that gets knocked out the window, probably, right?
Yeah, but here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that's fine, because I feel like it saves me a lot of trouble.
Yeah, a lot of unnecessary running and screaming.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so second question is, have you ever had a supernatural encounter?
Okay, I think so. I worked at a theater, which I probably shouldn't name, and the theater is in a park that used to be a medical park, and specifically the theater was above where they would bring patients back and forth through the different buildings. Primarily, the park was a TB ward, and underneath, I decided to go exploring, and I found the prop room, which had a lot of deer heads for some reason, so that was horrible. But then as I continued to travel, like, there was just a lot of weird stuff. Like, clearly the area hadn't been explored in a very long time, and underneath there were like square models of the park and these weird plastic bubbles, but then those would have like handprints on them, and I was like, that's pretty terrifying. Yeah, I didn't see a handprint go on there, but it scared the crap out of me. Anyway, I went down there with a friend, and we heard a whole bunch of weird noises. Who knows what it was? And that's pretty much it. We weren't sure what was going on down there, but we definitely felt scared and a little cold.
Sounds like the exact right place to find a lot of spooks.
For sure.
I think so. There was this one part where we heard this noise and it was terrifying. There was this creaky, really loud noise. And when we went to the source of it, because why wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Clearly, yeah.
It's like, it was the actual like room for the elevator in the building. And that was pretty rough. I got some chills.
That's why you're going to go first, Drew.
That's it.
Because you go towards the sound instead of away from it.
Listen, someone's got to go first.
That's true.
So your third question is, what were you for Halloween last year?
Oh, man. All right. Listen, I don't want you all to be disappointed, but for Halloween, I was a very caring father and walked my son around trick-or-treating.
You didn't dress up with him?
I didn't. I should have, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but I didn't.
Do you have any plans for what you want to be this year?
Okay, so I've been watching a lot of Hannibal, and I'm trying to think of a way to incorporate that into a costume. I just don't know how yet. I don't know if I could turn myself into a deer man, per se.
Yeah, absolutely. Some antlers, bunch of black body paint. Yeah, you could do this.
It is kind of fun because the adults would really be the only ones who got the joke.
Yeah, maybe I'll just walk around and eat a bunch of spare ribs and talk with an accent.
That could work too.
So, all right, cool. You did really good at that. That was fun.
Nice.
Sierra, Jackie, what have you guys been up to?
Ooh, not a lot. I just got back from a family reunion down in California, so I'm a little... sick of people because I've been in airports all day. I don't know. I'll try to be on point, but I can't promise anything tonight.
Wait, you said not a lot, but I saw pictures of you doing some stuff.
I met some giraffes and I met a zebra.
Awesome.
Which was fun. And I visited my grandma who collects Garfields and has a gigantic Garfield collection.
That was an insane Garfield collection.
Yeah. The collection is so big that you cannot capture it in a photo. But I tried really hard. And my grandma's awesome. And she turned 80 this year. So we all got together for her birthday.
Cool.
Nice.
Did everybody give her Garfields?
Well, she doesn't really accept any more Garfields because it's gotten too out of hand.
At least she knows her limits.
Yeah. And like, she's so cool. She has a Garfield tattoo. She's Grandma Garfield. So
she just couldn't be more allergic to Mondays.
Yeah.
Or more in love with lasagna.
I was really grateful for that new Facebook 360 camera.
Oh, yeah. I feel like we can share that to our Facebook page because it's pretty great. Yes. I'm pretty proud of it.
Is that what that was, the Garfield thing? Yeah. I like skimmed over it, but I'm going to have to go back in.
It's a panoramic of the Garfield room.
Yeah. So really take it in. Yourself.
Really get a good feeling of the imposing feeling of 1,000 Garfields staring at you.
That's awesome.
So I slept in that room when I was staying with her, and it's a little unnerving, to be fair, to sleep in a room with that many like hungry eyes staring at you. So I guess that's a little spooky that I did this weekend.
You're only hungry for lasagna, not for Sierra's.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Jackie, what have you been up to?
I had a similarly busy weekend. There was a wedding about an hour from my house that a lot of friends came in town for. So my house was like filled with friends all weekend, which was awesome, but, you know, also kind of exhausting. It's one of those things where like I had a great time, but now I just want to nap for 3 days and not see the sun or other people for a while. But I went to this wedding and it was a little bit weird. You know, there's a whole loving thing, this couple coming together and all that. But aside from that, like, the venue was kind of strange. It was, like, covered in all these literally hundreds of antlers and these taxidermied animals that were posed in, like, these really bizarre, extremely intimidating positions. Like, at one point, I was, like, sitting next to this fireplace, and I looked up, and there's this turkey that seriously was looking at me like I had personally slaughtered its entire family and ate them in front of it.
Down.
Yeah, I ate its children in front of this turkey, and it was coming at me. Like, it was a little frightening. Like, it was definitely, and it was in the middle of absolutely nowhere. So, like, if there were ever going to be a wedding horror movie, that would be a really great setting for it. But I'm glad that the actual event didn't go down that way. But yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting for sure.
I'm glad you weren't gored to death by, you know, back from the dead taxidermied creatures.
Yeah, it would have made an interesting story to come up with an epitaph for my gravestone, but... Yeah, glad we don't have to go down that road.
I think the most exciting thing I did this weekend was just go to the county fair, which is pretty strange. So it's the county fair. We did see this. We saw an act with like pirates, acrobatic pirates.
That sounds awesome.
Jumping and fighting and doing things like that. And we saw like motorcycle tricks, and I got a sunburn on my chest. So,
oh man,
that was the excitement of my weekend. I did have to have a meeting with Max's teacher this morning briefly.
Uh-oh.
He's apparently been playing zombie too often at daycare.
We knew this conversation was coming.
I know. She's like, he kind of told some of the kids that he might kill them and eat them. I'm like, oh God, are you kidding me? Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm sure he was just reciting the lines to a movie, which he does a lot. We just have to figure out which one it is that he's reciting and try to delete that from his memory somehow.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. So that's it. I'm really excited to get started on our What We're Loving Now segment because Drew, in particular, he just pumps out so many books on his podcast. And I have a feeling he's brought some goodies for us. So, Drew, I'm going to turn the heat on you first.
Yes, I'm so ready.
Yeah, tell me what you want to recommend for our listeners today.
Okay, I wasn't sure how many you wanted, so I have some, and you can just tell me When to stop. All right. So the first I'd like to recommend is this book called Random Acts of Violence. It is written by Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray, with art by Giancarlo Caracuzzo and Paul Mounts. And it's essentially about these two comic book writers who make a slasher comic. And one of the things that they've said is that they will draw you in a comic if you prove that you're the biggest fan. And someone does that by becoming a real serial killer and possibly hunting them down. And it's really great stuff, super violent, a lot of cool twists, and it's all in like 60 pages. It's really cool.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's published by Image, I think. And then just because I've been feeling a little nostalgic lately, I decided to check up on everybody's favorite witch, Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Ooh. Awesome.
In the new comic book that she has called The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Did you hear the way my voice cracked like a teenager? The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina is a lot like the TV show, if the TV show also had the devil in it.
Which is really what it was missing.
Seriously, right? It was.
And a woman who has, like, fetus skulls for eyes.
Fetus skulls?
That's correct.
Oh, you heard me.
Didn't know we needed that in our lives, but we did.
And some sacrificial goats and people getting turned into trees, and it's just... It is the most terrifying comic book that I've ever read. Like, legitimately, it's just traditional horror in comics. And it's got all your favorite characters. Harvey Kinkle's in there. Sabrina, Salem, those two aunts that I can never, ever remember the names
Zelda
of.
Zelda and Hilda.
Thank you so much. Hey, here's the deal. In this book, they're pretty sinister. Anyway, There's a woman who comes to town named... Madame Satan, and she basically wants to wreak havoc on the town and take down Sabrina, but I won't tell you why. It's good, it's terrifying, it's published by Archie Comics, obviously. It's a great book.
That sounds interesting. That sounds a lot darker than the TV show.
It is ridiculously dark.
That's awesome.
And the visuals themselves have this sort of sketchy style, far more so than the book we're going to be discussing today. There's a lot more like just hatch lines and stuff, and it's just a different type of horror, and it's to the roots. It's perfect. I recommend it to anybody and everybody.
Nice.
Yeah,
I've never gotten into any Sabrina at all, but I want to read this.
Well, before it was just like Archie Comics, but with Sabrina as the main character, like sort of like goofy fun. And then the TV show came around and there were a bunch of other comic adaptations that were even more like, I don't know, for kids. But then this came out of nowhere, probably stemming out of the Afterlife with Archie books. And it's fear. This book is fear.
That sounds so cool.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How about you give us one more?
Okay. The last one I have, one of my favorite movies, probably because it's one of my favorite games, is Silent Hill. And I recently read the Silent Hill Omnibus Volume 2. There's been a bunch of Silent Hill comics that came out, and a bunch of them aren't very good. But this Omnibus has all three of the good ones, luckily. It has one called Sinner's Reward, which is about a mobster that gets stuck in Silent Hill. Past Life, which is about a Wild West Silent Hill, essentially, when the town was first founded, with art by Menton 3, actually.
I have that one.
Yes, and then Downpour and Story, which is sort of a follow-up to the Silent Hill Downpour game and shows what this poor policewoman who was trying to get prisoners from one prison to another had to undergo when her bus crashed.
Just a side note here, Menton actually did our Sirens banner artwork that you see on all of our posts.
Yes, that's why I thought it was very important to mention.
Yes.
All three of those are collected in one volume, and there's a ton of talent on there. I mentioned Menton 3, but there's also Tristan Jones does a lot, and it's all written by Tom Waltz. And it's really good. If you like Silent Hill, or if you like people getting stuck in weird environments that they don't really know how to get out of safely, then this is perfect.
Nice.
Sounds cool.
Tristan is one of my favorites, too. He's currently doing the Aliens...
Oh, yeah.
Defiance? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. I want to say Resurrection, but that's not right.
Yeah, he's doing the current Aliens comic book series, which is really great.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Sierra, I'm going to check with Sierra next because I don't want to make sure that she's not going to fall asleep on us.
Okay.
Are you there, Sierra?
I'm ready. Yeah. The first one I'm super excited to talk about because it's one that I've been following on Instagram for a while, but it's pretty relevant for our topic today. It's this artist called The Hood Witch. I'm pretty sure she's local to Seattle, and she's just at The Hood Witch on Instagram and Twitter, and that's her URL for her website. She does really, like, practical
everyday magic kind of things,
especially geared towards women and women of color, and so how to, like, protect yourself and cherish your body and all of those kinds of things. And I think that her posts are just really, really beautiful. The book that we are discussing today, Harrow County, reminded me of her because it kind of brings up the idea of witches as an evil presence and also witches as healers. And so she's all about bringing back that, like, witches are powerful women who are around to heal and to help. So I would definitely recommend following her Instagram, but then she also does some, like, blog posts and things, which are pretty fun to read if you're into that kind of witchy stuff.
Witchy stuff.
Witchy stuff. Dance. You can always have more witchy stuff in your life.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. And then
the other recommendation that I have, it's more of a, like, something to get excited about. I saw a playthrough of this game called Stifled, and it looks super cool. It hasn't been released yet, but I'm pretty sure it's coming to Steam pretty soon. It's unique in that it is based on your actual voice. So it connects to, like, your microphone input while you play it. And as you talk or you scream or jump and make noises at all the scary things around you, it reveals your surroundings with, like, echolocation.
Oh.
And so there are things in the game that make sound, like dripping water, that will, like, show the wall around it. But beyond that, everything is just really, really dark. And you can't see it unless you talk. And of course, there are monsters everywhere. And as you talk, the monsters find you. So it's a balance between figure your way around all of this stuff. And you want to talk a little bit to see where you are. But you also want to be quiet so the monsters don't find you. But then if the monsters see you and you scream without thinking about it, they're going to come right at you. So it plays with that, like, almost a little jump scare, but also kind of just, oh, that's a scary thing in a game. Oh, no, this is really awful. I'm going to run away. Oh, God. And then it, like, comes at you more.
So I think that's just a really, really cool idea that I haven't seen before.
Yeah, that sounds really cool and
it's
unique.
It's so cool. Yeah. So I really want to play it. And it's right now, I think they're taking it around to, like, PAX and other game conventions. And it got funded, or whatever the thing is on Steam where all the crowd is like, green-lighted, thank you. Yeah. Where everyone's like, we want this, so they're going to figure it out. So
that's just
a thing to look for.
I will not play that because I just won't make any noise.
And then you won't get anywhere.
Yeah, no, it'll take me forever and I'll just be like, forget it. I give up. I'm not brave enough to make any sound.
But we may need to put that on our Twitch stream, I think.
I think so. I think that would be a really fun game to watch other people play.
Yeah, that's
and just to
so
play
cool.
yourself.
Is this going to be a virtual reality game, did you say? Or
It's just a PC game. You play it with a controller, and as you talk, it reveals things.
Oh, man, that's going to be nuts.
But it would be a really cool VR game, too.
Yeah, it would. It'd be a terrifying VR game. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I'd be so into that.
Speaking of exciting things, I just wanted to throw in here, Drew had mentioned something that sounds really cool coming up that I wanted to make sure he is able to throw that into the show so our listeners know about this. True.
Yeah.
Give him the secret.
I will. This is the secret as featured on Oprah. On the 12th of October, a bunch of comic book shops participate in an event called Halloween Comic Fest, which is a lot like Free Comic Book Day, which, in case you don't know, is a day you can get free comics. And that's on October 12th. And one of the comics that you can get, very relevant to this podcast, is the first issue of Harrow County. And it's got a new cover that is more for the season by the artist Tyler Crook, which features a very thin, very wavy character that everyone loves.
So
very awesome.
Very wavy character. So, yeah,
I'm assuming.
So we should probably all start checking local comic book shops to see who's participating with that.
Yeah, they have a bunch of other books, too. But I know that that one's probably going to be the most relevant. But yeah, you should definitely check it out. There's a bunch for kids, too, not just for adults.
Nice. Halloween comics for kids. Jackie,
very nice.
What you got?
I only have one recommendation for this week, and that is the movie VHS, which
yes.
is. Have you seen it? It's
I
so
love
cool.
this movie.
Yes.
It's a combination of vignettes by different directors, just short horror stories combined, but they all circle around the theme of this found footage kind of idea. Some of the directors in here, like one of them is David Bruckner, who wrote The Signal, which I recommended a few weeks ago, and a couple other episodes, which was fantastic. And you can definitely see his influence in his individual section there. And then if you've ever seen the movie Southbound, mm-hmm. like there are so many people from that worked on Southbound who became directors in VHS, like not just writer, you know, the writer and the director, but like people who played individual characters and the cinematographer, which is kind of a strange connection, I think. They probably, you know, all worked together on that and then decided to work on this other project. But the connection there I thought was pretty cool. Some of these vignettes aren't exactly winners. Like, there's one with a group of kids out in the woods, and they're talking about this strange glitchy monster, and it seems like it's gonna be cool, and then it kind of goes nowhere. But then others are just so impressive. Like my favorite one is one where a group of guys are going across town to go to this Halloween party, and they're not sure if they're in the right place because they've never been in the house before. They come in and they can't find anybody, so they start investigating and start hearing and seeing weird things, and they're like, this is the coolest haunted house we've ever been to. And then it's like, oh shit, this is really a haunted house, let's book it. And just things go haywire from there. But what's particularly impressive is the effects. Like, this is an extremely low-budget movie, but the effects are so impressive. Like, you have hands and faces coming out of the wall that legitimately look real. Like, I don't know if they did that with a latex wall or if it was CG or anything, but however they did the effects in this really impressed me personally. And I'm a big effects person, so that I'm like, I'm sitting there watching it like, wow, how'd they do that? That should have cost more money. What's going on here? So it's one of those things where when you're watching it, just take a look around and like really take in everything that's happening in the scene, from the colors and the sounds and everything to the actual visual effects that are going on. But there are so many different stories in here that there's going to be at least one that you really like, and several others that you'll also probably like. Another notable director in here is Ty West, who directed The House of the Devil back in 2009. He has his own little vignette section in this called Second Honeymoon, which is actually pretty good. But overall, I think it's a very nice mix of stories that come together in a nice way.
Awesome.
Did you see the there's a sequel too?
Yeah,
there's
I haven't seen the sequel sequels. Yet. Oh,
there's two sequels.
They're all on Netflix, at least last time I checked. Oh. And so there's VHS 1, 2, and VHS Viral, which is not good. But VHS 2 is really good.
I must have seen Viral. That's too bad.
It's like, oh, you want it to be so good, but then I try really hard to connect all of the little stories, and it just falls flat.
Did you say?
I love the first one.
Did you say what year this is, Jackie?
It came out in 2012.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like I saw it, but I can't remember it very well.
It's very unnerving.
Yeah.
I have two recommendations this time, and I'm going to start with the difficult one. What I want to recommend first is a comic series called Starve, which actually has two volumes out right now, and I've only read through the first volume, but it's one of those books that I just got sucked into right away, and I just could not stop. And I didn't think I would get sucked into it, but the story is by Brian Wood, who has been around for a long time, pretty well-known comic book writer. The art is by, I'm going to try really hard to get this right, and I was actually given a tip by Brian Wood on how to say this name, so I'm going to try it. The art is by Daniel Zezelj. It's spelled Z-E-Z-E-L-J. It's a Croatian name. So I'm sorry, Daniel, if I just massacred your name. I tried really hard to get it right. There's also art by Dave Stewart. So this comic book series it's about a famous chef named Gavin Cruikshank, and he's been in self-imposed exile for years. And while he was gone, his cooking show, Starve, evolved into a brutal chef against chef game show done for the indulgent enjoyment of super rich people. His enemy now hosts the show, and his bitter estranged wife owns it, along with most of his wealth. And he's been brought back to the show, basically to fulfill a contract that he has with the company. So he is attempting to bring the show down by winning it, and he's also struggling to win back the respect of his now grown daughter, who he abandoned years ago when he put himself into exile. It's hard to explain why I consider this part of the horror genre, because there's not a lot of scary out and out horror involved in this. It's kind of more like a hostile type game show where they're pitting these chefs against each other in really brutal ways. And just so a kind of example of part of what I loved about this story, there's they keep giving them these challenges, and his enemy Roman is trying to make things really hard for him to win. And at the same time, his ex-wife is basically trying to take him down by getting him beat up or killed or whatever she can do to him. So they have a challenge in particular where what happens is they send out, they put the chefs into little teams of like three people, and they send you out to other restaurants around the city. And what you have to do is you have to try to forcefully take over the restaurant so that you can cook in it. And the people who are working in the restaurant don't want you there. There are these like battles that they have to go in and just like beat the shit out of each other in these big battles to try to get into the restaurant to cook. And then once they get in there and they're able to get access to the kitchen, then they have a very short amount of time to cook whatever it is that they're told specifically to make.
So it's like pirate chefs basically taking over another vessel here.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. And I from what I gather, it's kind of an alternate future setting where there's a lot of foods that are kind of extinct at this point, or really, really difficult to get, which is why the super rich are the ones who this show is made for, because they are the only people who can afford to kind of throw away all these expensive foods and watch people make fancy dishes while everyone else is struggling to get food on their plate.
All right.
it's like pre-apocalyptic almost. Like, it's right before things go really, really bad.
Right.
Yeah.
So I didn't think it was going to interest me that much. I hate cooking shows. but I just, like, the story, it's Brian Wood, and he writes a hell of a story. Like, he really builds a world really quickly. He's got a great way of writing these, like, really anarchical, just insane, like, off the chain stories that about, you know, different realities that we can only imagine happening. And I read this book and I just got sucked into it and I couldn't stop.
I guess we know what was missing in our current, like, our modern cooking shows now to really get the crowds involved is, you know, mayhem.
Right.
I tried explaining it to a friend of mine, and I was like, okay, so picture Chef Ramsay having to be in his own show, but also being a character in The Warriors.
Right. Right. It's like Mad Max in a cooking show. but it's really great because the chef, the main character, Gavin Cruikshank, is actually a very respectful kind of chef, and he has a lot of respect for the art of cooking, and he's trying really hard to kind of reestablish that and hold on to it while the rest of the world has just kind of devolved into this nasty pre-apocalyptic reality show.
That's so funny.
There's this really touching relationship between him and his daughter at the same time, and he's trying to like make amends for walking out on her years ago. So that's that. My second recommendation is a big stretch for me to call it a horror recommendation, but fuck it, I'm gonna say it anyway. it's an animated film called Jack and the Cuckoo Clock Heart. Has anybody seen this?
No.
I discovered this on Netflix kind of accidentally in a desperate attempt to try to get my son to watch something other than the same three movies he watches every day. And he was not into it, but I kept watching it all night. Like, I actually banished him to go play in a different part of the house so I could finish watching it. So it's about, it's a 19th century drama about a man whose heart was replaced with a clock when he was born. The situation dictates that he should avoid feeling strong emotions, love most of all, but as you can imagine, things go in that direction, and he ends up falling in love, and his life gets really hard because of it. This was based on an original French version, which translated, I'm not going to try to say it in French, translated as Jack and the Mechanics of the Heart, originally released in October of 2013. When I started watching this film, the animation is really beautiful to begin with, but when I started watching it, what really struck me was the music. The music is incredible. And this is not operatic kind of Disney-esque music. There's so many different musical influences. And my husband was in the kitchen cooking when he heard it, and he's like shouting in from the other room, like, what is that you're watching? The music is great.
Do you know who the composer was?
Well, so this is the interesting thing. I looked it up, this movie, and the film was based on a concept album by a French band called Dionysos. It's D-I-O-N-Y-S-O-S. Mm-hmm. And the story itself is based on an illustrated novel written by the band's lead singer.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so this band, Dionysos, I'm assuming that's how you say it, they actually created and conducted all of the music for the movie. And the music jumps around throughout the film. There's scenes that feel kind of punk rock, very hard. Mm-hmm. Then there's scenes where it feels almost like a soft kind of like dance house kind of thing going on, like Portishead mixed with some old like 80s era punk. It's just put together in such a beautiful way. I immediately was just struck by the music, and the music just makes the film. And it's just this really, really touching film of this really young little boy who, as a baby, his heart doesn't work. And this midwife, who's this some kind of creepy lady who lives up on a hill all by herself and everybody's scared of her, she dives in and she replaces his heart with a little cuckoo clock.
Thanks.
And it's really... It's hard to explain. I feel like there's definitely a horror element to the story, even though the whole thing is very charming. It's very dark. It's very kind of gothic looking. The colors are very heavy in it. Jack the Ripper makes an appearance at one point in the story. So I don't want to give too much away about it, but it's got a very kind of Burton-esque feel about it, where the characters feel very quirky, but very smart. Mm-hmm. There's something in the dialogue where a lot of the characters talk very fast. And if you listen very carefully to what they're saying some really incredible stuff. Like, I want to go back and rewatch it just to hear all the dialogue, because they put together, some of them talk like kind of in rhymes, but it's not obvious that they're rhyming until you really listen to the dialogue closer. Yeah, it's just a beautifully, beautifully made movie. And I don't know how I've missed it up until now, but it's definitely a love story, but it's a dark gothic love story. And... oh, I know. I'm so not into love stories. I don't even know why I'm telling you guys to watch this, because I hate love stories. Oh. Yeah, this movie was so adorable. It just grabbed my heart. And there's a great scene where they go to a circus sideshow, and there's these really strange and incredible creatures just flying around and tumbling. There's like a face that looks like a sun that's kind of tumbling around on the ground, making faces in the background. It gets very surreal. Trippy. Yeah, it is. It gets very trippy and surreal, but the characters are just super lovable and interesting, and every one of them seems to have a very like strong personality of their own. So, yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I'm going to watch it again, probably many times, and hopefully convince my son to watch it at some point.
I'm going to show it to my child.
But he was not into it. He was like, what are these people doing? He just didn't want to watch it, but... The songs are pretty fantastic. So I would really genuinely like to hear, if you guys watch this film, what you think of it afterwards.
For sure.
Super unique movie.
We'll report back. Prepare a quiz.
Report back. I want reviews from everybody.
I'll tweet you.
Okay. Okay. So that's it for our recommendations today. Today's topic is, if you haven't picked it up yet, is the comic book series Harrow County by Cullen Bunn and Tyler Crook. It's published by Dark Horse Comics. We're going to jump right into that just after a quick break. And we're back. So I just wanted to give everybody a heads up. We're going to handle this discussion in a very specific way to avoid spoiling anyone, because Harrow County is an ongoing series that is still unfinished and being released in single issues. And we don't want to ruin the enjoyment for anybody who's just getting started on it. So first, we'll introduce you to the book. We'll get some general impressions on the story from Jackie, Sierra, and Drew. And then I will give a warning before we go into any deep spoiler heavy discussions from there. So a quick starter on this. tell you a little bit about Harrow County if you're not familiar. Harrow County began as a prose story called Countless Saints, which was run on the website of Cullen Bunn and retired after 10 chapters. The story was then reincarnated as an ongoing comic series with artist Tyler Crook. Most of the single issues contain extra materials and backstories that cannot be seen in the trade paperbacks. So if you're a trade waiter like I am, you might want to grab the singles if you really like this book. Harrow County is a southern gothic fairy tale about a young girl named Emmy, who learns on the eve of her 18th birthday that she's connected in a special way to the creatures, ghosts, and monsters that inhabit the woods around her home. Part coming of age, part horror, this series has given us a very unique spin on a classic deep woods supernatural story. The story is unique because it interlaces the idea that things really are lurking in the shadows all around us and the harshness of the reality we all face as we move into adulthood, like realizing you and your family are not immortal and that many of the things you thought you understood about people are just not right. Emmy is thrown into a new reality of both who she is and what the rules of her world are. To start off our general impressions, I actually just wanted to let Jackie jump in here first because she's got some cool information on Haints for us, which I think is great to talk about first since this story was originally called Countless Haints.
Yeah, apparently Haints are something that goes back, the idea of Haints is something that goes back centuries here in the real world. As you guys know, I live in the deep south here in Savannah, Georgia, and something that is really common here that I never realized there was an actual story behind is when you walk onto somebody's big spacious porch, the ceiling is often painted a very light pastel sky blue. In my research here with the Harrow County, I stumbled upon this article, oddly enough, printed by Sherwin Williams, the paint company. The color is literally called Haint Blue, and it's all about why homes in the South always have the Haint Blue on their porch ceiling. It's supposed to trick evil spirits and scare them away, making them think it's extending the daylight and making them think that's the color of the sky, thusly protecting the family that lives there. It's a little bit strange because, you know, here in the South, like a lot of the homes are based off of Victorian design. Like there are lots of columns and sharp edges and all that. And in that design, there's a lot of like very earthy colors, like olive greens and yellows and mustards, all that kind of thing. And then you come onto the porch and there's this very strange, soft blue-green color. And it's just, it's so common. It's bizarre. And it really does clash with a lot of the exterior colors of the house. But it's something that, you know, if you ask somebody, why is your porch ceiling blue? They're going to say, well, my grandmother did it and her grandmother did it. And they may not know why that started, but it was to protect you from evil spirits.
So have you painted your ceiling of your porch light blue yet?
No, mine is actually painted white. And I was actually, as soon as I learned this, I for serious couldn't remember the color of my own porch ceiling. And I went outside and I'm like, oh, it's white. That's lame. And it's, I know they had just repainted everything right before we moved in a couple years ago. So now I'm not even kidding you. I'm going to paint that damn thing blue. Like it's going to be Haint Blue out there now.
You should chip away and see if there's blue underneath.
I bet you there is. Yeah, cool. I really do. Yeah.
That's really cool. That's really interesting. Jackie, this was your first time reading the series. So can you tell me first what you thought of it? What are your general impressions without any spoilers?
I absolutely loved it. I went ahead and bought the actual novels here, the trade paperbacks, because I just like the feeling of holding a comic in my hands when I read it. And I blew through both volumes within 2 days. Like, it's an easy read, for one, and it's a fascinating read to me, so I didn't want to put it down. But what really blew me away about it was the artwork. I think the artwork is absolutely incredible, and there are stories in the back of, I think it's the first book here, where Tyler Crook goes into why he did the watercolor style, and he really wanted to give a certain feels to this, and they go into details about what characters they wanted to have a certain impression of based on the colors and based on the style there. If you do pick up the first volume, I very much recommend just going back and to the back of the book and reading through that and really taking that in. I don't want to really give away any spoilers by mentioning specific characters, so that's all I'm going to mention about that specifically. But it is all a watercolor style, and it's not done, the watercolor is not done digitally. He hand-painted all of these frames So they're very unique and they're very beautiful. They're very, very colorful and they meld nicely. So if you're into nice artwork with your stories, then I really think that Harrow County gives you a very nice place to view that from. And the story itself, to me, I absolutely love supernatural horror. This is like horror porn to me right here with all this gorgeous artwork and then a supernatural story like that. And I mean, and it's based here in the Deep South too. So I could relate to that on that kind of level as well. And it's just, I'm kicking myself for not reading this sooner, basically.
It's okay. That's what I'm here for.
Exactly.
Sierra, what did you think about Harrow County on your first read?
I agree that it's so, so beautiful. And this, in addition to it being hand-painted and all of that, that must take so much time. But it's obvious that both the writer and the artist put so much detail and love into this book. Like, I'm a graphic designer and I do, like, zines and things like that. So I'm really interested in, like, how you portray the emotions of words and stories in visual forms. And I think they do a really good job of being really thoughtful about the speech bubbles and how different creatures or different characters have different styles of speech bubbles. Like, even to that detail, it's really, really thoughtful and beautiful and very immersive when you read it. I sped through it too because I was just in the world and I wanted to know more about these people.
That's awesome. Drew, I know that I specifically asked you to come on for this episode, not just because you're another comic nerd, but because I know you really love this book. So can you tell me just kind of briefly your general feelings about Harrow County?
Yeah, of course. Harrow County is absolutely haunting. Like, every single thing about it just reads something that would scare you. Like, there, with every page turn, you don't know what's going to happen next. And I think that's really important. Cullen Bunn likes to be in this era of horror. I know you've talked about Death Follows, and it's the same sort of era. He does the same with Sixth Gun.
He loves that Southern Gothic horror, right?
Absolutely. It's great. And I think that he's really kind of found his niche here, because what he's given us is something that feeds off of some obviously old tales, as Jackie has told us, but something new as well, a new story for us to sort of grasp onto and make it feel a little more human. Like, if you were to see a horror movie in this time period, you would be like, yeah, it's a horror movie. You know. But like, reading this, like, he makes the sinister forces of the book very sinister, but he makes the human moments really human. And of course, Tyler Crook's art aids that in a big way with all of the facial expressions he uses and the design of some of the things that the characters interact with throughout the story. It's great.
I recommended this book as our first big, like, we did cover Preacher, but we combined it with the TV show. I think this is our first, like, focus just on comic book show that we've done.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I recommended this one. So obviously I'm in love with Harrow County myself. I'm completely caught up on it, so I went back and reread Volume 1 and 2 to prepare for this. There's nothing extra that I can really add to the praise that you guys have said here. So I just want to throw in that at the end of Volume 1 and 2, the print editions, there are some really beautiful variant covers done by some couple of my favorite artists in the back. Notably, one of my favorites is Joelle Jones, who's Lady Killer, I mentioned, I think, on our last episode. She's the artist of Lady Killer. And then there's also a fantastic one by Jason Latour in there. And then there's one by an artist named Jock, who does some really cool, very kind of like shaky, wiggly artwork that I always enjoy. Now I just want to use the word wiggly. So yeah, Harrow County is amazing, and I am super psyched now to just dive into some really in-depth discussion about these books and all the different themes going on. So obviously we all loved it. We have a lot to say about it. This is your warning. The discussion from here on will include spoilers. So if you have not read Harrow County yet and you want to avoid spoilers, you should stop listening right now. Go read Harrow County and then come back and finish listening to this episode, because you're going to miss some awesome stuff if you don't hear the rest of it. So I'm going to start with sharing something that I read in my research, which was an interview with Cullen Bunn discussing this book. In his interview, it was with Comic Book Resources. He said, there's some pretty serious stuff going on in Emmy's life, and it's not a situation where you're going to see Emmy with a sword fighting these creatures. Despite the fact that we're dealing with all these supernatural elements, Emmy has to deal with them in a very grounded, very real-world kind of way. This is what I want to talk about first, the fact that we're given a young girl who's just learning how to become a woman. She's trying to support her aging father and their small farm. She suddenly realizes that she has the ability to communicate with and at times control the haints and spooks that lurk on the peripheral of her world. If anything, I think Harrow County is the worst kind of coming-of-age story we could have, one in which this girl can't focus on her internal demons like every other teenager does because she's facing all manner of real demons in front of her. This is kind of the angle that I wanted to focus on first, because I think, to me, I suspected that this is what Harrow County was really about, and after reading a few interviews with Cullen Bunn, it really felt like that's what he was focusing on as well, was Emmy and what's happening with her life and the fact that she's not your classic comic book hero. She's just a little girl trying to fight her way through life. Mm-hmm. So how do you guys feel about this idea and these big themes going on in this book?
Well, it seems like they're going to combine this idea of her internal demons and her outer, like, real right in front of her demons together here, because she does have to make some difficult choices in terms of what path she wants to take, you know, meeting her sister and learning her past and realizing she comes from, you know, an evil witch kind of thing. Like, does she want to be evil with them? Does she want to be the good witch? Like, what does she want to do here? And I think it's interesting that we open up the story with Emmy sitting there talking to her friend Bernice about what she's going to do with her life. She's about to turn 18, and does she want to stay on that farm forever? Does she want to sit there and take care of her dad? And Bernice, I guess we assume that Bernice knows her past. They didn't actually say that specifically, did they? If Bernice knows where Emmy came from?
I don't think they said it.
I don't think they did. Bernice's father definitely does, because he questions her dad right in the beginning, but I don't know that Bernice knows quite at that point in the story.
Yeah, but Bernice seems to be really pushing Emmy to go and explore the world and, you know, not just stay in one place her whole life. I mean, that's something that everybody can relate to. At one point in your life, you're, you know, becoming an adult thinking, where do I want to go from here? So I like that Cullen Bunn kind of draws you in with that same decision that we have all looked at one point in our lives of where you want to go with your direction in life. And then they throw in this entire huge kink of, well, wait a second, you also have to deal with this nonsense.
You mentioned Bernice. So I'm interested in Emmy's relationship with Bernice, too. And in more recent issues, it looks like Bernice has grown quite a bit and her ideas of what Emmy's going through have matured. So do you think their friendship can survive Emmy's new situation in the world? Do you think that their friendship will get stronger? Do you think it will be kind of taken apart by Emmy's new status, I guess, as the local powerful witch that everyone is fearful of?
I haven't read the newest issues. I've read through whatever volume 2, whatever we decided to keep this discussion to. But I think up until that point of the story, I'm really, really curious to read more because I want to know how Bernice gets more kind of knowledge and power, and the little hints she got about learning about the snakes and how to capture them and kind of learning her own secrets and things. I'm really interested to see how she could become almost just as powerful as Emmy in her own way, and how she could, you know, they could team up and work on it together. That's where I want to see it go.
I kind of think that Bernice kind of holds the turning point for Emmy, because when Emmy looks at her dad, she sees him for who he is. She sees someone who has hidden her and kept her safe. And I think that that's something that she can't let go of. Bernice, I feel, is the one real source of innocence in Emmy's life. She's essentially the human part of Emmy's life. And I'm not caught up either. I've read these two trades. Besides that, I don't know. So this is just me talking. But I think that somewhere down the line, maybe soon, who knows, I think that something's going to happen to Bernice, and it's going to affect Emmy in a really serious way. That's just the feeling I get.
I feel like the relationship with Bernice is complicated because in the beginning it seemed like she was obviously fearful of Emmy.
Yeah.
And she wasn't really sure she wasn't sure if she should be helping the town find her. She wasn't sure if she should be helping Emmy escape. She was very kind of confused about it. But obviously this is a coming of age story, so these girls are growing and getting older, mm-hmm. you know, and the way that we deal with the hardships of our friends, I feel like, changes quite a bit as we mature from childhood into adulthood. So
absolutely.
There's a lot of tension around Emmy feeling like she needs to protect Bernice, and Bernice feeling like she can take care of herself, and feeling like she kind of wants to be seen as somebody who can also, you know, help capture monsters and help fight things and keep the town protected. Like, it seems like they both have a lot of the same goals right now. In the same interest.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's interesting that we're in this, I would say, what, early 1900s, 1920s time period, somewhere around there.
Seems
yeah,
about
kind
that,
of flapper
yeah.
era.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that Cullen Bunn hasn't knelt on the crutch of racism in the South in that time period. He's let Bernice be her own character with her own goals and her own personality without having to rely on what society thought of her at the time. And I think that that's important.
I found that interesting too. In fact, as soon as they introduced Bernice and her father, I was kind of bracing myself for that.
Yeah,
you know, seeing the time here, I'm like oh no. Oh gosh.
It's gonna get bad.
And well, you hear Emmy mention, right, that her father doesn't like him for some reason. And I'm like, oh God, here we go.
Yeah. Yeah, but I was pleased to see that that hasn't come in yet. I mean, it seems like it would give a little bit of a real world feel to it if he does bring that in at some point. But I was glad that that wasn't, you know, a real hanging point for the story. Like, it's not about that.
I feel like he has handled the, you know, the genuine segregation that would exist at that point very gently.
Yeah.
I feel like he has portrayed in a certain soft impression to you as a reader that Bernice and her family aren't completely, you know, in the same space as the rest of the community, that there is a certain amount of segregation going on between her community and what Emmy lives and the people that Emmy surrounds herself with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you notice that there was the when they explained to you where all the townspeople come from, many of the scenes with showing the townspeople, there are no Black people in those groups.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Bernice and her father probably live in a separate area of the neighborhood. You know, I think about like Boardwalk Empire, where there was this sort of like whole different section of neighbors that they had to go, and they always had to like go to this different part of town to visit.
Yeah.
To visit the Black community. And yeah, there's many scenes where you see like the whole groups of neighbors and everyone who was created by Hester, and they, I noticed that right away. Like, it was kind of like, oh, those are the townspeople in that group, but like none of Bernice and her family are there.
Yeah, they evade all of those mob scenes.
Yeah,
they do.
But they're, you know, it's handled in a very gentle, soft way, which I think is really nice. It's a very sensitive way to handle what obviously exists in that time period. I think it's still pretty unclear right now who the antagonist and the protagonist are in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to have flip-flopped a little bit here and there as the girls find their way through what's happening. Do you think that that is an intentional part of Cullen Bunn writing the story?
Well, it definitely keeps me on my toes.
Yeah.
I think it's intentional. I mean, okay, so here's another crazy theory. I think that from what we've seen so far, and I just want to make sure we're in the spoilers now, right? We're
good. Yes. Oh, yeah. We're in the spoiler zone.
Okay, cool. So Cammy and Emmy, I essentially view as, I think the way Cullen Bunn intended, which is a bit of a yin and yang. At the very beginning of the story, or pretty soon in, when Emmy is found in the tree, there's another girl found with her. And I guess we're to assume that the other girl was Cammy. I don't know for sure. But the way I see it, Emmy represents healing up to this point. And Cammy represents destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And they're two parts of one coin. And together, they would, if they joined together, then they would equal Hester.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at that, I think.
I never thought of it that way, actually.
I mean, at least so far, unless Emmy has some crazy change, which she very well may. I mean, maybe, yeah, who knows?
Yeah, that seems like part of her struggle going forward in terms of the coming of age story is she gets to make a choice of whether she wants to be the antagonist or the protagonist. So that's, I feel like that's something that's going to be a huge plot device and huge turning point for her as a character, is which path she's going to choose.
Well, and, you know, I am further ahead than the rest of you, and we don't want to discuss anything really past volume 2. But I just want to say that it hasn't gotten any more clear to me at this point with the introduction of more characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who is the antagonist and protagonist. So I do kind of feel like this is a bit of a fun game from Cullen Bunn that he wants to keep us all wondering where the bad guy and where the good guy are here.
He's really good at that.
Melissa, do you feel like there's going to be like an ending point where she is firmly either an antagonist or protagonist, or is he just going to keep bouncing back and forth on here?
The point I'm at currently, I definitely feel like she's being pushed towards having to make a decision. I think that whichever decision she makes, whether that makes her a good person or a bad person, is still going to be left as a very subjective thing, depending on which way you look at the situation she's given. So
that's fair.
It doesn't get less complex.
She has to decide if she's a good witch or a bad witch.
Right. Probably somewhere in the middle, right?
Why not?
So speaking of Cammy, now we've brought her up, Emmy disposed of Cammy fairly quickly, I feel like. Do you think that that's the last that we'll see of her evil twin?
No, I don't think so.
I feel like it can't be, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Like Drew mentioned, it seemed like such an important part of who she was. Like, that just can't be the last of her.
That's why I was surprised to see her kind of disposed of so quickly and easily. She was just like, you want mom? Go ahead.
Yeah. Down and that was it. I was like, yep.
Okay, bye, Cammy.
Can we talk about that moment for a second? Because, like, that was the first time, like, in the presence of the story, the present day of the story, that we actually, like, saw Hester do something. So, like, what was that all about?
Yeah, it seems like she's still in play a little
bit. Kicking.
Maybe Emmy kind of summoned her.
Right.
Maybe Emmy has the power to, like, bring her forth a bit. Yeah.
Unless that's if they come together, that's the sort of effect that they have.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say because Cammy obviously had the power to summon Haints as well, right? And control them.
Yeah.
And does that mean that Hester falls, like, she's technically a Haint now?
That's a good point. And in that case, does that mean that Emmy is stronger than Cammy?
Yeah, geez.
So many questions.
Oh, I know.
Oh, I
maybe
have so
one of
many
us
questions.
Should just write a letter to Cullen Bunn. Like, let's just solve this.
He's not going to tell us.
Dear Mr. Bunn, reveal the ending of your story to me, please.
I have enclosed cookies to bribe you.
So I think there's a lot to talk about with Hester, but before we go there, I want to take a step back a little bit because I think there's some really cool things that happen right at the introduction of this story that I don't want to forget to discuss here. In particular, the Skin Boy introduction.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of comics that I've read that that kind of punch you in the face so quickly into the book as this. I've never picked up a book and seen a girl carry home a new skin that she found in the forest, like within the first 10 pages.
Mm-hmm. And so nonchalantly, too.
Right. Yeah. She's like, okay. So it seems that Emmy was unnaturally comfortable just grabbing that skin and taking it home with her. Do you think she even noticed how strange that reaction was? Do you think that she felt like what she was doing was out of the ordinary, or?
It kind of makes me wonder, like, I want a mini series about her childhood growing up to see how many Haints were just, like, hanging around and if that was just normal for everybody or for her, because it was definitely, she was not fazed by it whatsoever.
Yeah,
and
I'm with Sierra on that.
She didn't think to, like, oh, I should tell an adult that I just found a murdered kid. Right. And so I feel like this is just her normal, and maybe she doesn't know any better to know that it's weird.
I think that she just has sort of an understanding of it almost, just because she is from Hester. Like, she's legitimately just a part of Hester. So if Hester understood Haints, then there's a good idea that Emmy would also understand the Haints.
But she doesn't question at all why she understands the Haints so well. Like, the way she talks about them, it's just, like, such a normal, everyday part of her life. And, like, coming across the Skin Boy, she's just like, oh, okay, come here and don't be afraid of me. I'm not going to hurt you kind of thing. Like, why?
Maybe part of it is also that the Haints know about her, too. So if all of these creatures are kind of, treating her like, oh, yeah, it's normal that you're here. So she's like, oh, it's normal that you're here, too. Yeah.
That's fair.
At least one of the Haints knows about her, but I'm sure we'll get there.
I don't know.
The story starts, I think, with her saying, that she suspects that these Haints are out there, but she doesn't really know. She just knows that there's something. She's always suspected that there are these things around her. And so I feel like when she meets this boy is almost the introduction to that. Like, it's her first step into that new place. Like, I don't think she thinks he's a haint the first time she sees him. She just realizes that, you know, he's not just a regular boy, that yeah. there's something strange going on. I think she even makes a remark at the beginning where she says, oh, you must be a haint. You know, she kind of realizes that he's not just some boy running through the woods. It's almost like the minute that she's kind of given a step into her new world, she just very quickly understands. It hits her very quickly, like this new thing, like, oh, okay, so these are the Haints I always thought were there, and I can talk to them, and they're real, and okay, we're just going to pick this thing up and take it home and move on.
Yeah.
You know what the most unsettling part about that Skin Boy is to me, is that, like, when he's first introduced, he has a speech balloon that just has H's in it.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh, God. Like, that, I can picture the noise he's making, and I'm like, ugh, that's unsettling.
See, I like that when they first introduce him, he has a little stuffed bunny nearby.
Yeah. What happened to that guy? Did she have that later on, that rabbit?
I don't think so.
I think the rabbit got left with the body part of the boy, right? His other half. Yeah, there's actually a moment, I'm looking at this page again, where she finds the skin, and there's a panel where she's talking about, like, how his breath smells like a slaughterhouse, and she's describing what he looks like, and then she says, another ghost, another haint, whispering its secrets, trying to tell Emmy something. And she's just got these big wide eyes, those great facial expressions that mm-hmm. Tyler Crook does. And I think that's just the moment that she's realizing, like, wait, he's a haint, and this is what I'm supposed to do now, is take care of these things. And that's when she, like, snatches the skin up and takes it home, like, I'm the haint mommy.
Yeah. I think it's also worth noting that at 18, I'm struggling, you know, it's obviously coming of age, so it's like she's a kid, but she's an adult, and a big part of her growing up is being a mother to these haints and having that motherly instinct, so, like, I guess that is why it makes sense that she would just want to take care of it.
Yeah.
She probably should have given that thing a bath, though.
Yeah,
for real.
Just take him home and stuff him into her clean dresser. Mm-hmm.
This will look great.
Do you think that the Skin Boy is a protective spirit of sorts for her, like a guide?
Yeah, I definitely think so. He definitely, you know, he gives her warnings anytime mm-hmm. danger is near, and he specifically goes, like, sends his skinless body out to watch the mob chasing her and to, you know, give her feedback of what's actually going mm-hmm. on. So
attack he definitely anybody seems that's like, gonna harm her.
Yeah, for sure. He definitely seems like a protective spirit there.
Yeah. Cammy's got a butler. I think that this is Emmy's sort of bodyguard, or I guess her mm-hmm. familiar. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's her butler.
Yeah, and Cammy actually
her skinless yeah, butler.
When Cammy saw the skinless boy, she remarked, oh, you have a familiar as well. So
oh, did she? Okay. Yeah.
Nailed it.
Emmy's father, do you think that he took her back purely out of guilt or fear or real love? Because I feel like he did actually literally try to kill her and mm-hmm. then accepted her back into the house. What do you think was the initial reason for why he accepted her back in? Do you think he had a choice?
I think he really loves her. I have a feeling, like, obviously not everything has been revealed, but I have a feeling that when he was first given Emmy, that it was more of a sense of duty sort of scenario, and that's why he lives far away from town. But I think that over the years, as he raised her, he sort of grew to love her. And even when he's, like, hunting her down or whatever, I'm pretty sure that the only reason he's hunting her down is because he'd rather that it would be at a familiar hand and that he would know what happens to her than to just for some stranger to just, like, you know, destroy her, mutilate her, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he does try to protest it at first.
Yeah.
I suspect that it's a combination of those things. I think he really loves her. I also think he feels a lot of guilt immediately after for trying to kill her, as he should. Bad daddy.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that he is fearful of her, like everyone else is. I think that he realizes that if she wants to come home and live in that house, he's not going to be able to do much about it.
Yeah.
She proved very quickly that she had more power than him. So
yeah, more power than everyone.
If we think about Hester's influence in there, Hester supposedly made him. So in effect, and Hester made him and he raised Emmy. In effect, he is both a father and a son here. So he probably has a very, very complicated mix of emotions.
That's very complicated, Jackie.
I didn't even think about that.
You just took this to a weird place.
I was going to say not weird enough.
Well, we have already talked about skinless boys. And
yeah.
Something interesting, and I don't know if this has anything to do with his involvement, but in the first couple pages, there's a gentleman in overalls and a hat that originally sets Hester on fire. Mm-hmm. And if you notice, that's his outfit in the book, is that same hat and the overalls. So I don't know if he's necessarily the one who set her on fire, but when he does, if it is him, he says, "God help me." So I feel like he feels some guilt towards the fact that he did it, and that might be why he might take Emmy in the first place.
Trying to redeem himself.
Yeah, I think he legitimately feels, but he's just a nice dude.
Is he, though?
I mean, is he? Sometimes, you know?
Now I really want to talk about Hester, because we keep mentioning her name, and I feel like this bitch is crazy.
Yeah.
I really want to get into Hester.
I want to know her backstory so bad.
Yeah.
Like, more of it.
Yeah. She's a complex character for sure.
So the book begins by telling us the history or the story of Hester's death, which is terrible and brutal, but also mentions that she was a healer at one point. So why do you think she went bad, and did she actually go bad, or did their feelings just change about her? And do you think Carroll County will ever escape her after what they did?
I don't think she went bad, personally. I think that the town, and you actually have a note here, Melissa, about the ignorance of the town and how they feel toward the magical ways there. I feel like the town just sort of turned on her in that they decided that what she was doing was unnatural. And more to the point, they do mention that they saw what she does in order to keep her magic going, which involved a lot of death and a lot of things they didn't agree with. So they liked the healing aspect of that, but they didn't like that it came at a price. And because of that price, they just flipped on her.
Well, she was doing some weird things with the kids at the end, right?
Yeah.
And like killing a bunch of cows.
Oh, that's true. Well, I think that, you know, she made a lot of the people in the town, and she was doing a lot of healing. And I think that that maybe the healing that she was doing, like, it's pretty clear that the Haints have always been around. Like, she might have brought more around, but they've always, like, been around. And I think she's always sort of known that. So I have a feeling that she was doing, yeah, some pretty shady stuff, but also sort of a protection thing for the town. And not only that, but she knew that her end was coming. Like, she made preparations. She talked to her own familiar to be like, "Hey, listen, stuff's gonna go bad." Like, she made him hide. So I have a funny feeling that whatever she has going on, it wasn't completely sinister. Not all on the up and up, but not all sinister.
Do you think that there's a power aspect element here that has something to do with Hester's downfall? I mean, she created, she's kind of doing the classic, you know, God image thing here, where she's created her own followers.
Mm-hmm.
And she's made this space for herself where she can pretty much do what she wants, and people are too fearful of her to object until the very end. And I wonder if that power and that ability to create life at her whim, if that had something to do with her changing practices.
Mm-hmm. It kind of corrupted her a bit.
Right. Do you think as a witch that she's not open to the same, you know, flaws and the same character tarnishments as anyone else is when you're given too much power?
I feel like maybe at this point of the story, there's even room for there to be an even larger power that had maybe overcome her and controlled her or caused her to switch that we just aren't even aware of. So she's kind of almost a like a red herring or kind of thing, where we think it's all just she's the evilest of evil, but really there's this bigger picture, because we also know that there are a bunch of other witches and creatures and things out there.
That's an interesting possibility.
And there's this there's the collection of people that Emmy just met that the psychopomp took her to, who we don't really know a ton about yet.
Yeah, and she didn't make everybody in town, right? She just made a bunch of the people. So
I think, yeah.
And it seemed like everyone was pretty surprised when they found out that, well, when Emmy like liquidated three of the people that Hester made. So I think it might have been a combination of mob mentality and then because Hester made a lot of those people, that might have been why she didn't take them out herself when she was in trouble.
Right.
Well, and that one character, I can't recall his name, who actually grabbed Emmy that time and basically kidnapped her. You remember him the talking about... guy? Yeah, he was surprised to see that the people were turning against her because he thought that they were all, like, there to serve Hester and take care of her.
Yeah, and he seemed like Hester's familiar, right?
Oh, yeah. Or at least that little snake he had in his ear.
Yeah.
He seemed like a kind of right-hand man, almost. Like, she trusted him well enough to be like, you're going to see me again, and even if you don't, or even if I don't know who I am, it's up to you to tell me and make sure I know what to do.
Yeah.
If people hadn't read this story, and then they listened into this podcast, and they're like, I just want to hear about a cool witch story, they'd be like, what? This is crazy.
It would certainly inspire them to read it, I think.
We talked a little bit about, like, Jackie brought this up. I had made some comments in here about the theme of ignorance here, which always comes into play when you're talking about witches, I think. Mm-hmm. And whether it's from the city folks towards the country folks, or it's also from the locals towards Emmy or towards Hester. Obviously, the public murder and burning of a witch is an age-old representation of that kind of ignorance. So how do you think that sort of ugliness will play a role in the story later? How do you think it's going to affect the turning of the story?
I think that's definitely going to depend on where Emmy decides to go with her life. Like, is she going to stay there on the farm and in that little town, or is she going to move on? Because there are two different possibilities there. One, the town turns on her again. Or she goes somewhere else, tries to do magical things, or accidentally does magical things. Mm-hmm. And she has an entirely new set of people that need to react to how she is.
Mm-hmm. I could see the story going as she entrusts Bernice to kind of take care of the town, take care of her dad, and let her know if anything goes wrong with the Haints and all of that kind of stuff. And then she kind of goes out and explores the world and maybe looks for more answers, or is sent out on kind of a quest by this group of... I don't even know what their title was, the group of other magical kind of people that we just met.
Mm.
The clay people?
Are they the clay people? There's like the skeleton guy and the psychopomp guy.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I can't remember
their
name.
Yeah, it's like they're kind of like a coven or something.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that we saw very little of Cammy in the city. But mm-hmm. What we did see, it looked like she was pretty well off. And now there's a little girl from the city that's gone missing. So what kind of attention will that bring to the small town?
Yeah.
Right. There's going to be a crossroads for Emmy where she could either learn from Hester's history and handle her magic and her place in her community in a totally different way. Mm-hmm. Or she could end up inadvertently taking herself down the same road.
Yeah.
And that kind of history repeating itself thing. You know.
Since she knows the history, though, of Hester for the most part, it seems like she has a better understanding of how to avoid it if she wants to.
I think, though, that when she learns more about her mother and what happened with her mother, I think that might be the catalyst that kind of makes her decide.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Maybe. I feel like when history repeats itself, it doesn't tend to do that because we knowingly made the wrong decision, you know?
Yeah.
It ends up being like a hindsight thing where you go, oh, shit, I did the same thing and I didn't mean to.
Like, damn it, I wrote it on my hand and all. Do not do this.
That about covers everything that I had to talk about. Do you guys have anything else that you want to cover that you think we missed in this?
I'm just really excited to see where this story goes.
Me too.
Yeah, I don't know how long it's supposed to be going on. I guess until sales drop, if ever. But it seems like it's moving at a great clip. There's not like in the 10 issues or however many have come out so far. What is it, 13?
I think it's 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, at least in these first two trades, like, it doesn't slow down at all.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, if it keeps moving at this clip, then we're looking at like something that could be legitimately considered like a horror classic.
Right.
It was mentioned that this is being turned into a television show, right?
That's what I was just going to say. There's a mention on the wiki page that Universal Cable Productions and Dark Horse are developing a TV series.
Interesting.
But that's, you know, They say that a lot about comic book series, and
yeah,
you know, it doesn't always pan out into something.
Took us forever to get Preacher.
You know, if they can make Preacher into a TV series, they can make anything into a TV series.
That's
so
that's true.
I'm a little worried about them turning this into a TV series. I think they'll have the sort of Game of Thrones syndrome where, like, they got to a point where they're like, we don't have any more stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's too new, I think.
Yeah,
there's a lot of great... I totally forgot one of my recommendations was going to be the Outcast TV show, which is based on the comic book series that I've kind of been... I've been, like, marathoning that for the last couple weeks, and I'm really, really into that show. And I think they've done a great job. And that's another one that's a really complex story with a lot of characters and a lot of things happening at once, and they're doing a really great job with it. So, mm-hmm. you know, Harrow County is it's complex in its character development, but mm-hmm. it's a fairly simple story overall.
Yeah.
With a fairly simple theme.
We'll see if it stays that way, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have faith in it.
So I think that's about it. We had a great discussion about this. I think we really pieced apart the themes that we could find. We're probably not going to be able to depend on Cullen Bunn to tell us any secrets.
Even if we bribe him with the cookies?
Maybe. Hmm. We'll try. We did have one comment from social media, and that was from our follower, Sammy Castle. He said he wants to know, how cool would it be to have a second set of skin in a drawer, like a winter skin and a summer skin?
Like one you can actually wear?
Yeah, he specifically said a winter skin and a summer skin.
I mean, I've got a onesie. Does that count?
Kinda, yeah.
That's kind of like my ongoing winter skin, the onesie. Right? You just put it... It is like a skin, because you just put it on and wear it, like, every day. Come on. I know I'm not the only one who wears the onesie all winter. maybe not Jackie. She's in Georgia.
Yeah, wait. What's winter again? No.
Yeah, no, I think that... I mean, I guess that would kind of be cool, because then if you get, like, skin cancer or something, you could just switch your skin out, right?
You got a backup.
Or if you get tired of your tattoos, you have other options.
That I would like.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be different fun. Themes. Yeah.
Going with the sea theme this week.
That sounds expensive, though. Mm-hmm. You have to
Oh, for sure.
These are my work-safe tattoos, but now I can go into my going-out tattoos.
Well, you know, I could really use an extra set of chest skin right now. Switch out until the sunburn calms down. All right, so I think we covered everything. And Drew, thanks for joining us for this discussion. It was really fun to have you on.
Absolutely. Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
I don't think I said this before, but I was actually a guest on your show one time.
It's true.
Yeah, and we had a blast. I think it was Halloween, wasn't it?
It was. We talked about all the spooky reads. We talked about, like, six, I think. Not all of them. Six.
Yeah, it was a lot, though. We packed them in there.
It was great.
So thanks, everybody. The Sirens of Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. Visit meganerdmedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. We're getting a lot of fun stuff over there, and I'm really kind of excited about it. So you can reach us via email at sos@meganerdmedia.com and on Twitter at Sirens of Scream. Sierra, where can listeners find you?
I'm on social media at Sierra Hauk. And I also do the Sirens of Scream Tumblr, so you should follow sirensofscream.tumblr.com.
I'm sorry we keep forgetting to mention that.
No, it's okay. I really like talking about it, though, because I'm really secretly proud of it.
You should be. Mm-hmm. You really should be.
Thank you.
We'll get that added in to make sure we don't forget it every time. Jackie, where can everybody find you?
I am Jackie the Robot, all one word, on Twitter and Instagram.
And Drew, where can we find you?
I am also on Twitter at JustDrewVG.
And do you want to tell us briefly about your show?
I guess I should. I have a podcast called For the Love of Indie, where I go into independent, creator-owned, and small-press comic book properties. It's on a hiatus right now, but it should be back probably on this coming Monday or Tuesday.
Everybody can find me at Lissapunch. I'm on Twitter, Instagram. So that's a wrap for this episode. The next episode coming up, we are going to be talking about children in horror. And I believe we're going to have a special guest possibly set up for that one. That's a big maybe, but you should be excited anyway.
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about children in horror, and kids are scary.
They are the creepiest.
They're terrifying. And if you are listening to this and think you would be a good guest, we love having guests on, so you should tweet at us and we'll figure it out.
Or vice versa. All three of us are happy to join you on your show if you've got one.
Especially if you like dated 90s catchphrases.
What?
Will you do me a flavor? Cowabunga. We'll break those out for your podcast. We've been saving them.
Righteous.
I was totally not ready for that. We do say rat a lot, don't we? Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, guys.
I hear rah 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 rah. I hear rah.